Welcome to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we focus on the impact of local, state, national, and global issues on the health of the individuals, the families, and communities in the Central Catskill region. The murder of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson generated an outcry about health insurance companies and their policies. Last week, Dr. Adam Brown wrote a commentary for MedPage Today titled, "Insurers are dictating care and we're sick, sick, sick of it. Now is a moment ripe for change." Dr. Brown is a practicing emergency physician and the founder of ABIG Health, a healthcare growth strategy firm. And I want to welcome Dr. Adam Brown to today's program. Adam, thank you so much for joining me today.
I really appreciate you having me here today.
Great. So your commentary really was in response to the murder of United Healthcare executive Brian Thompson. And I think we've all been seeing that there have been on social media, in the news media, a huge outpouring of reactions to this, some that are a little disturbing because as healthcare providers, we would never condone murder. But something compelled you to write this column. Tell us about that. Why did you decide to do this?
Yes, I think it's a great question. And I think part of the reason is because my first inclination was there was a few events that came together and that we should discuss. It was Thompson's murder, the decision by Blue Cross and Blue Shield around Anthem's Blue Cross and Blue Shield around anesthesia. I can talk about it in a moment. And then the reaction to those events. So one of the other things I do is I'm a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in the business school, and at the business school ESCP in Paris and London. And so a part of my goal is always to use my columns as a point of teaching and then as springboards to teach the general population. And I saw the confluence of those events come together and saw we have an opportunity to educate. Yeah, I've been writing for MedPage for a little over a year and a half, and my column there is called Prescriptions for a Broken System. And so if some of your listeners want to go back and look at the column, you'll see a lot of commentary that I make in general about frustrations with the private insurance system in the United States. But at a high level, what struck me as the opportunity to comment on this was the reaction, and you mentioned some of it. And it was because I think that I saw that people were training a lot of their frustration onto the CEO and almost looked at the person who allegedly killed him or murdered him, as we saw on television, almost looked at him as a hero. And I thought that was a really wrong thing. And so it struck me that, you know, people are rightfully angry and appalled at the strategies of our private insurance companies. But cheering on the murderer or cheering on the murderer who killed the CEO is really not the answer, because we should be appalled at the loss of life and the struggles of this family. And as I say in the article, no one should lose their life because of a business decision. But that sentence serves two purposes. One was to say no patient should lose their life because of a health insurer's decision, and no executive should lose their life because of general business decisions. So I saw the kind of confluence of those things, the Anthem decision, Thompson's murder, and also the responses as a, here's an opportunity to educate the public on some of the challenges that we're having in the public or the private insurance system.
Yeah, really, really good reasoning. You also, in your article, and at the end of the interview, I'll have you tell people how to find this commentary. But in the article, you give some examples, and you talk about a recent one by Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Share that example.
So it's interesting. You know, I think there's a lot of mystery around how physicians bill or how companies bill on behalf of physicians and then how those bills get paid. And so Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield had made a decision to start to create limitations on how much an anesthesiologist would be able to bill for a specific type of medical surgical procedure. And so the new policy would have reimbursed doctors, anesthesiologists specifically, based on time limits, and those time limits were set by the insurer. And so you have to understand how anesthesiologists historically have built, and they bill in units of time. And the reason for that is because some surgeries take longer than expected, some take less than expected, and patients are different. They're not widgets or cars running through a factory, you know. So anesthesiologists are dealing with life and death situations because a patient is under and they're not breathing on their own typically during these surgeries. And so there's a lot of effort and critical care time that's involved here. And so they bill on time. And so the outcry was, how can an insurer want to limit my reimbursement when I'm still delivering care? And then carrying that forward, what type of incentive does that create? So I suspect, just like so many things that insurers do want to do, are to reduce costs, which is their direct expenditure. But you have to look at what the economic incentives are. And those economic incentives become to either decrease anesthesia time, underbill, or erect administrative hurdles so that if more time is required, there has to be an authorization process. And so you can kind of carry that further and see how that could really create some complications for physicians and potentially for patients down the line. And so predictably, there was quite an outrage associated with it. And they reversed their decision.
Yes, that was really important, I think, that they reversed that decision because of that outrage. And then we've talked a lot on this program about prior authorization, but for people who may not understand prior authorization, I think it's important, particularly within this context, to talk about it, because on the bullets of the alleged murderer, there were the words deny, delay, and depose. Tell us about prior authorization.
So it is one of the most headache-inducing systems for physicians. And if you talk with physicians...
And patients,
exactly. But 94% of physicians believe that it's a huge time sink for them. Actually, the AMA came out a couple of years ago and said that per week, prior authorization is about 2 work days worth of uncompensated burnout-inducing time, administrative work. And so what it is a physician makes a decision to either treat a patient with a drug or some type of diagnostic like an MRI. But before they can do that, they want to make sure that the insurance company will actually pay for the procedure so that the patient is not saddled with the bill at the end of the day. And so that process can take a really, as I mentioned, a really long period of time. The problem has become many of the insurers, and we know this from reporting from ProPublica, from lawsuits, from reports in other news media and testimonies before Congress, that many of these companies like Cigna and UnitedHealthcare and others have used algorithms in ways to review these cases and immediately deny them, setting up even more of an administrative burden and hurdle. So what you start to see is that there becomes a near punitive type of action on the part of the doctor for trying to order certain tests and services. And then the problem for the patient is it just becomes a burden for the patient in delaying care for them, what they eventually need. And so, you know, I think if you look at, it's a little less so in the emergency department, which, you know, happy to discuss, but it still does happen. The prior authorization is a little different than claims denial, but prior authorization is a big burden on the parts of hospitals and also physicians without a lot of value. It's just this money savings technique on the part of, I should say it's a part of a money savings technique on the part of the insurer.
And initially it made sense that the insurers were asking for prior authorization on very expensive procedures, not all of which had strong evidence behind them. So it
Correct.
Sort of made a little sense in the beginning, but now it's even on standard medications, isn't it?
Correct. And I think that is where we start to see where the initial policy, which did have good rationale. It is good to have some level of oversight to help with the control of spending. I mean, healthcare is not an unlimited resource. And so we need to ensure that good decisions are being made. But what initially was a more collaborative process and one that could give feedback under a utilization review or feedback on, you know, this type of procedure is not necessarily evidence-based or recommended, has become really a tool to create barriers to reduce costs, i.e. expenses, on the part of an insurer. And you have to remember, the way that insurance companies make money is they get premium dollars or they get dollars from the U.S. government through Medicare Advantage. And the money that they make off of that, if they keep it, great. But if they spend money on care, that reduces their profit margins. And so you can see that some of these tactics have been used to, you know, the public say reduce healthcare costs, but what it really means is to increase their profit margins.
Yes.
And so I think that's where they saw a tactic that initially had some good could be leveraged to increase their profitability, in my opinion.
Now, as an emergency physician, you just noted, you don't deal a whole lot with the prior authorizations, but maybe you could share some of your other insurance company nightmares that have really gotten in the way of patients getting what they need and want when they need and want it.
So you're right. So in the emergency department, the first thing, we operate under a federal rule that came out in the early 80s called the EMTALA Act, and that prevents me or hospitals to require billing or insurance information before a stabilization, evaluation, and treatment of a patient that comes into the emergency department or patients that are in labor. And so so prior authorization doesn't happen when a patient's coming into the emergency department. But there's one specific example that it does that I have personally experienced. I live in Washington, D.C., and we have an insurance company that operates here in the district that does require that anytime a patient is admitted, that we have to call them. So let me paint the picture. So if a patient has this particular insurance and they come to our emergency department, I have to call that insurance company and I have to speak with another doctor with that insurance company to get an approval and approval number to get that patient admitted. So just imagine, you know, it's a busy ER. It's usually busy in the ER. We're short-staffed in nursing. That's common across the country. There's several hours of wait in the lobby. The average is around 2.5 hours. And I am working with my physician assistant. We're seeing patients in the department. And I have a patient that's extremely sick with severe pneumonia, maybe sepsis, that requires admission. There's no ER doctor in the country that would say, hey, let's send that elderly patient home to try to deal with it themselves. Like, everyone would say this patient needs to be admitted. But yet, I still have to page this insurance company. I still have to give a brief summary to the intake person. Then I have to wait for a callback from the doctor. That callback could be minutes. That could be an hour or two. Then I have to tell the story to that doctor who says, yep, Dr. Brown, they need to be admitted. Great. We agree with you. Remember, they're not seeing the patient. And then we have to wait for them to find a bed at their chosen hospital that takes that patient insurance. So we now have to wait for another processes. Now, I've just explained to you in about 60 to 70 seconds that process. What I haven't added is sometimes we have to call multiple hospitals to find a bed for that patient that takes that insurance. And so this process takes time. The patient is waiting in a bed. It takes resources of me having multiple conversations with doctors. And that's because of one singular insurance company here in the district that is the process that they have agreed to with multiple hospitals here in the district who see those patients. And so that is a form of prior authorization. I have to have an authorization to get them admitted, and I have to have an authorization to keep them at my hospital or to transfer them to a hospital. It's different for patients in the primary care office or surgical offices or things like that. But in the middle of an emergency department, I'm having to do some of this type of work. And so you can imagine the time that it takes and the potential delay in care and pulling me away from other patients who need care as well.
And when you talk about the health of healthcare and you think about the infrastructure that we are paying for all of this, it's absolutely ridiculous having the insurance company have to pay for people to second guess the clinical decisions that you're making, having the people on the front lines and in the emergency room and in the hospital or primary care center who are having to do all the paperwork and phone calls, et cetera. It really clearly is not benefiting the healthcare system's costs. It's really, as you said, addressing the bottom line and profits to shareholders. So I actually am interested, though, in your thoughts on, there's been some attention to when you make that call and you get a physician who calls you back to say, yeah, this patient needs admitted, some physicians are saying that they're given algorithms that they're supposed to follow, and that for some of these physicians, they find it morally reprehensible because they're being told to deny care when they don't think the care should be denied. That plus the potential for AI to be who you're talking to. Are these going to complicate this scenario even more?
So within the emergency department, that I don't face that as much. And it's very specifically a singular insurer in the D.C. market that follows this type of protocol. And I've been practicing around here since 2008, 2009. So and it's been a very similar type of process. But we do know that AI is being used based upon others reporting and is being used in prior authorization. And so you made a comment about, in this company, when I do call them, I do speak with a physician. And let me be clear, some of these physicians I've known for years that I'm talking with. They're like, oh, hey, Adam, it's great to talk with you. And they're good doctors, and they do give a collaborative discussion, and they have access to all the patient information, which can be invaluable. But it's the process surrounding that, and it's even the need to give a call that becomes problematic. In the case of AI, where there are concerns is how are those algorithms made? What are the inputs for those algorithms? Mm-hmm. What type of patient population are they utilizing for the algorithms? Are they taking into consideration other confounders, things like the social issues that the patient may face? Or are they taking into consideration other medications that the patient may try, or services or surgical procedures the patient may try? So AI has a potential of clearly reducing some administrative burden depending on where it's applied, on the provider side or the payer side. However, it can also be a tool that could be used, if not used correctly, could create a lot of headaches and also leave a lot of gaps.
And in those, just to go back to a moment with the conversations with the physician that you know at this one insurance company, so is that a benefit to you to have somebody who's concurring? Or if you had your druthers, would you just be able to do what you think is best after having been the person to see the patient and not have to get the approval?
Correct. So it's a great question. So in the ER, we are always operating off of limited information because of time and sometimes access to medical records. And so having another physician on the other line when needed is very helpful for doing a couple of things. One, if they have access to the medical record, they can see what that patient had done in the past, and then there can be a collaborative discussion around what could be best for the patient in the ER and then even after the ER. The second is, if you are sending a patient home that may be still ill but does not need to be placed in a hospital, but I want them to be seen in clinic or be seen as a follow-up sooner rather than later, that conversation can be also very good on behalf of me speaking to another doctor and understanding the fuller context of the patient's disease or who the patient is. But it also is good for the patient. So to be clear, when it's a physician to physician or clinician to clinician type of conversation, that can be very good for patient care. But it's not always needed for every patient that comes in for admission, and it's not always needed in that moment. And it certainly doesn't need to be if it's obvious the patient needs to be admitted, where there are multiple hurdles you have to jump through to get them the care that they need.
So your column said, now is a moment ripe for change. That's in the title. What do we need to do?
Well, We should be outraged currently at the system. I mean, in the United States, we pay twice the amount than any industrialized nation, comparative nation in Europe and elsewhere, Australia, et cetera. And, you know, on average, an individual can pay $7,000 to $9,000 a year for private insurance, and for a family, the average is $23,000 a year. And so we should be asking insurance companies, why aren't they getting better? But what's happening is they're just getting bigger and bigger, and they're consolidating. When you have the top five insurers in the United States that have over $1 trillion in revenue, that's more than 137 countries in the world's individual GDPs. So I tell my students those type of things as a framing, because what do we need to do? Well, the first is we've got to get educated as a population. We need to understand how the money flows. Who are the players? Who are the key stakeholders? So we've got to educate ourselves as doctors, nurses, clinicians, patients. Second, we can't fall into the trap of the simple terms of, like, healthcare, we want to keep it capitalistic or free market, or we don't want to be socialized. Because the fact is that healthcare in the U.S. is not in a laissez-faire economy. It's currently very much guided by regulation, and the U.S. government is granting winners and losers, and I think we know who the losers are right now, patients and clinicians. The third is insurance companies cannot own all components of the value chain. If you look at UnitedHealthcare, they have the nation's largest pharmacy benefits manager. They make their own pharmaceuticals. They're the largest insurer. They have the largest number of physician employees. So they have a lot of control along the value chain. And if they do have that control, we need to start thinking of them like we do utility companies, because they're becoming too big to fail. And so that means we need to have some regulatory step in. The last two things, fourth, we've got to have more transparency into the insurance costs and pricing. And fifth, we've got to have accountability. Listen, Congress and regulators are what control how the game is played. And so, you know, these companies, just like any business, they are leveraging regulation to the best of their ability to make the most profitability. So if we want that to change, we've got to change some of those regulations. I mean, some will say, hey, we want to abolish fee-for-service, move to value-based care. Some will want me to say, let's go to Medicare for all. Those are very simple political things to kind of say in a very, very complex system. But it starts with educating ourselves.
Well, Dr. Adam Brown, a practicing emergency physician, founder of ABIG Health, and a regular columnist for MedPage Today, writing the column Prescriptions for a Broken System. Thank you so much for coming on to Health Center in the Catskills today and talking with us about this. And maybe we can have you back on when I follow MedPage Today, and so I'll look for your columns and would love to have you back on again.
Hey, it's truly a pleasure. Thank you so much. And you can also find me on LinkedIn. I have a lot of commentary around similar things around health policy there as well.
And that's Dr. N, right? N initial. Do you use that on LinkedIn?
I do. On LinkedIn, it's Adam Brown, MD, MBA.
Adam Brown, MD, MBA. Thank you so much, Dr. Adam Brown, MD, MBA. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
All right. You too. Bye.